Well, good day. Welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and as always, we are so happy to have you back joining us and listening into this episode. We're going to be talking about quite a few different odds and ends, including addressing a comment from one of you, the listening audience, so stay tuned for that. And before we get to that, though, of course, we have to bring Sam Bradley in. Sam, how's the snow out there in Colorado?
It's weird, Jamie. I woke up yesterday morning and it was a blanket of white, although obviously not a lot. And then by today, 90% of it's gone. So we go from green to white to green to white.
Yeah, that's kind of what it's
keeps
like
things here. Keeps things interesting. So I don't know. Kyle will have to tell us if we got anything on the coming in. But you know, there's a lot of weather going on elsewhere in the country that our meteorologist Kyle Nelson will tell us about. And we got Dr. Joe here with us tonight.
Hey guys, how are you?
And Joe has a new puppy. We've been playing with his puppy on Skype here.
I do.
And
his name is Sherman because he's like a tank. So
he's a cutie. And then Chris Pressman, some of you may remember him. We've had him on a couple times down there in Oklahoma. So I think we have some really good perspectives for tonight. So Kyle, the forecast is just there hasn't been anything that we haven't had any lulls. Let's put it that way. There's been a lot of weather going on. So what are we looking at coming up?
Oh goodness, Sam. Well, just hello everyone on the Disaster Podcast. Kyle Nelson here, meteorologist. Just wanted to say that yes, it is an active weather pattern from coast to coast. We just recently finished up a pretty significant winter storm event that spawned not only winter weather hazards, everything from heavy snow in the mountains to ice and mixed precipitation from Arizona all the way to the Midwest. But now we're looking at our next storm moving onshore in the Pacific Northwest. So all of you in the Washington State and Oregon region, I'm counting at least 15 different weather products currently in effect, at least coming out of the Seattle, Washington National Weather Service office. So everything from ice storm warnings, winter storm warnings, high wind warnings, avalanche advisories and things. So big takeaway from this is being weather aware, because we are into an active weather pattern here across the U.S.
Yeah, and there's ice scares me. I mean, I could deal with snow, but man, that icy stuff. I watched something on the Weather Channel this morning about, yes, it may look like it's wet, but it could be ice. And there's nothing that scares me more than that, and I'm sure everybody else as well. Would you agree? Have you had to deal with that much, Kyle, up in your end of the woods here in Colorado?
No, fortunately, where I'm at in Colorado and in most of the mountainous areas in Colorado, we don't get the temperature set up, the vertical temperature structure that's necessary in the atmosphere to give us those freezing rain events. Fortunately, anything that falls for us usually will fall as either all snow or mixed precipitation, but freezing rain events are exceedingly rare in the mountains of Colorado. Unfortunately, that is not the case out in the Great Plains, where this recent system, I think I'm seeing at least six motor vehicle-related fatalities reported as a result of icy roads. And I think the largest accumulation I've seen so far is just over an inch of ice in one area of Oklahoma. So big, big impacts.
Whoa, Chris. So I didn't think you guys got that kind of cold weather down there. What has it been like for you?
Well, we did experience exactly what Kyle's talking about, a little west of Oklahoma City, kind of on a northeasterly track. The Clinton-Weatherford area up into the Enid area did experience that with some heavy ice on, obviously, infrastructure creating some power, you know, grid problems. But fortunately for the greater metro areas of Oklahoma City and Tulsa, we kind of dodged a bullet with some of that warm air coming up out of Texas. Luckily, I was in Nashville over the weekend enjoying some hockey with my son, so I didn't experience anything. I drove back and it was 50 degrees and I have shorts on today, so We're in good shape.
That kind of ice is at least something you have some control over. So, and actually, it was interesting, Kyle, too, something we haven't talked about, but another thing I caught on the Weather Channel this morning is the danger of icicles. And it showed Jim Cantore pulling down this icicle off this house that weighed about 35 pounds. He couldn't even hardly hold this thing. And I thought, wow, you don't think about that too much. But, you know, people walk under those, and when they're starting to melt, that could be really dangerous. Would you not agree?
Oh, absolutely. And it's actually quite a big industry in the more metropolitan or the city areas, where there are companies that are specially equipped to remove icicles from the high-rise buildings, because, you know, as you can imagine, even, you know, an icicle, which I think the footage that you were referring to with Jim Cantore was off the side of a house, and you can only imagine how large they can grow on some of these taller skyscrapers and things. And if, you know, one of those should happen to fall and accelerate with gravity on its way down, it could have catastrophic effects at the bottom. So if you're ever walking through an area and there are signs warning you to walk further away from the buildings, closer to the road, and saying, hey, danger, falling icicles, heed those warnings, because you don't want to find out the hard way that those signs truly mean what they say.
Yeah, and I remember them saying 15 people a year are killed by icicles. So that is something I did not know until this morning. So, Joe, you get ice stuff down there in Memphis, don't you? Didn't you have a big ice storm down there one year?
Yes, we. You know, it's fairly rare for us, and of course, we're not very well equipped to handle it. So they're pretty catastrophic when they hit, but thankfully, they're fairly rare.
Well, that's good. Well, you know, the thread that weaves through just about all of our podcasts is that of preparedness. So, regardless of what we're talking about, it usually involves, you know. And what Kyle said is true, just being aware, situational awareness, and whatever weather situation you happen to be in is probably the most important thing. But we had, and actually this goes back a couple of months because we've had so many other timely topics to talk about, but I didn't want to forget about this. But he's kind of new in the medical arena. I don't think he said exactly where he was, but he works in kind of a rural environment and
This is the listener that left the comment on the Disaster Podcast site, right?
Right, yep. Michael, yes. But I'm not sure that he said exactly what state he was in. But, you know, it probably doesn't matter. But he said what he's been picking up in our podcasts are just these little hints on, you know, stuff we're talking about in terms of kits and so forth. And he wants to really put together a minimalist first aid kit for serious life threats. So you got kind of a double-sided thing there. So he's looking basically at gloves, an N95 mask, pocket CPR, tourniquet, of course, base blanket, 4x4s, and duct tape. So that's kind of his basic list. So if we can kind of help him expand that or not, we'll see what you guys think. But, you know, as I was thinking about this podcast tonight, I was thinking about all of the different kits that I've had in different scenarios in my life. Joe and I are talking earlier about DMAT and USAR. And of course, because we're deployed for 3 weeks at a time, we have to bring everything with us because the team itself has to be self-sustaining for 72 hours. So that is a load, 80 pounds of stuff. But there's been that. There's been work in the ambulance, work in the ER, work in ski patrol. I did Red Cross disaster work, which involved a ham radio element, so there was a lot of that. Then did some tactical medicine, which is a whole different set of gear. And just basic everyday, what do you have in your car, what do you travel with, and so forth. So each of those things had different elements to it. But I want to share one thing with you, and I want to see what you guys think. But I just finished a book that Dr. Joe's been helping me with. And part of that is my hero is out there looking for some people. So he has to do some hiking into the forest of a Caribbean island. And so he's looking at what he's packing in his bag just for that period of time. Jerky, dried fruit, energy bars and water, first aid supplies and OTC meds, variety of survival supplies, including flashlights, water filters, drinking cups, a compass, a multi-tool, duct tape, a lighter, fire starter, paracord, work gloves, a bandana, fresh socks, an assortment of cable ties, a Foley catheter, dental floss, which comes out of the last book, and some survival gizmo we had forgotten about, which turns out to be a smoke bomb. So, Dr. Joe, what are you thinking? Let's just look at a wilderness, austere environment where you're going to be out there for, say, a couple days without a whole bunch of nothing. So you, whatever you need, you're going to have with you. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's interesting, Sam. First of all, thanks to Michael for the email that he sent us. It was really interesting to read, and we're happy to talk about it. This is actually a subject that the USAR guys have had to deal with some. We often have a very light recon group that might be six guys that are going to need to travel very light. They're going to be moving through rough terrain very quickly. And so we've sort of struggled with what do you take with you, you know, as the medical guy on that approach. And, you know, we've struggled with things like AEDs and oxygen and medications and all that sort of stuff, and ultimately decided it needs to be pretty lean. So we shoot toward things to respond to an anaphylactic or allergic reaction, like Benadryl and maybe Epi. You know, aspirin or nitro, just because some of our guys are older and heart disease is not an uncommon scenario out there. And we at least could get initiated, you know, initiate some kind of therapy with aspirin and that kind of stuff. I think the things that he mentioned were otherwise certainly pretty appropriate. But I think it's often a tough decision to figure out what do you take and what do you not take and still feel like you're meeting the expectations of the group that you're there to support. So, you know, for us, the idea that if a guy had a cardiac arrest 5 miles from, you know, any kind of support at all, what were we going to be able to do with that guy? And the answer in reality was not a whole lot. You know, an AED isn't likely to do much good way out there. And if you're that far from help, then you might as well be out in a wilderness environment, because it's going to take a long time to get backup and extrication and all that sort of stuff in there.
Yeah, and that's about the only thing on his list I would have had a question about, the pocket CPR mask or barrier, because first of all, we don't do that much mouth to mouth anymore. And like you said, if you're, and it kind of tags onto your comment about oxygen. First of all, that's going to be heavy. It has its own hazards. And if you get somebody that needs oxygen in that kind of environment, first of all, it's not going to last that long. And second of all, you better have a means of evacuating a person that needs oxygen fairly quickly. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would. And that was part of our thought process was, you know, yes, I can appreciate if you got a guy having, you know, exertional angina under that situation, then oxygen's the right thing to do. But you're right there. You know, there's a great toll with the size and the weight of carrying an oxygen cylinder around with you. And when you get right down to it, how much difference does it really make? And is it going to be a life-saving intervention if you need it? It's a pretty rare circumstance where that would be the case. And we just decided that it didn't make sense to lug that big, heavy cylinder around with us for the relatively few opportunities it would be where that would make a big difference.
Exactly. And I think in general in medicine, which is a whole new podcast, but the use of oxygen isn't as critical as we thought it was for a lot of things. So I think aspirin for this guy with angina or, you know, early stages of an MI is probably the most important thing. And I didn't think about that. So that's a good one. So, Jamie, you of all of us probably work in a more rural environment with your volunteer fire stuff and so forth. What are your thoughts?
Well, I like what he initially put together. I think it's a good list of you know, getting started. I too, for my area, I carry a CPR pocket mask, but that's because I'm not so rural that we wouldn't have response coming. I think if you're in a more austere environment, the need for a CPR mask would only be something of importance if you thought you could have additional resources come on a timely basis. Otherwise, you're probably CPR is going to be a I would consider it an effort that might tie up resources needed for other things in a disaster setting. Joe, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would, Jamie. I think that's a really challenging situation to be in. You know, I can appreciate that a pocket mask and that sort of stuff are relatively small and lightweight and are hardly going to make or break, you know, someone's ability to carry that stuff with them. But I think you have to look at it in terms of, does it really make sense to do prolonged CPR in an austere environment when resources are going to be a long time getting there. And the answer is it probably doesn't. But I appreciate that there's also sort of the psychological effects, you know, from the rest of the team of we're going to try and we're going to do the best we can for this guy. And that psychological component is certainly important. But, you know, I think a lot of this has to do with really fine tuning the kit that you're going to carry to fit the situation that you're going to be in. With the realization that it's going to vary quite a bit depending on how austere you're going to be, how quickly is backup going to be available, what's the likely problems you're going to face. Are we going to be in a situation where I've got a bunch of 60-year-old guys out there I'm working with, or are these a bunch of 20-year-old guys? That changes the likely medical conditions that you're going to face. And I think, you know, you have to take all that information in and make some choices that seem to fit the environment that you're going to likely be in.
Well, as well, I think it's the number of people, because if you're going to be doing CPR for a prolonged period of time, you're going to have to be able to switch people off. Then you have to consider how many people is going to take to try and get them out of there. So that's a whole different dynamic. Chris, down when you're flying around in an F5 tornado down there in Oklahoma, what's in your kit besides a parachute, maybe?
Well, you know, that's kind of interesting because obviously, you know, working for the EMS provider in Oklahoma City, we carried the largest Thomas pack we could, which we could take care of 100 patients out of very easily. And we felt every bit of that weight as we moved around in those, you know, initial stages of that response. But, you know, as obviously we learned as we went along, and you know, one of the interesting things is as I'm listening to the panel, and I think Dr. Joe brings up a very good point, is you know, we now have the thought process, especially in the tactical medicine realm, of IFACs, and maybe it would be a thought for him to, as Dr. Joe said, evaluate his team. And you know, if you're working with a large cross section of different ages and, you know, different risk factors and different health histories, maybe you tailor your team, your team's individual IFACs to maybe what would be pointed to them, and then maybe set your initial response bag up to, you know, get off the X, so to speak, plug a hole, you know, stop a bleed with a tourniquet, occlusive dressings or chest seals. And, you know, I agree with the panel. Extravagant and you know, big life-saving measures in those arenas are not going to be productive, and you're going to suck up resources that would be better served dealing with other issues.
Well, Chris, you know, this was some years ago now when that F5 actually, we're not kidding when we said he flew around in an F5 tornado. That was his first MCI. Did the engine, not the engine company, but the ambulance company and all of the other disaster resources, did they really rethink the MCI supplies that they carried? Because we were talking about the one guy who ended up by himself in a school gym with about 100 patients. I mean, it's hard to know what to prepare for. Obviously, you guys were carrying stuff for a lot of people, but how was that before? Would that have been accommodated as easily as it might be now? Were those changes made after that tornado went through?
I think there were some par level changes on the units as far as stocking goes to be able to maybe handle a few more patients in that, you know, arena that we were talking about in a singular building in a gym, and those types of things. And then obviously statewide, we have some trailer assets that could be moved into those areas that are, you know, set up for 50, 75 or 100 patients. The bag levels never really changed that much. And interestingly enough, if you do have a chance to watch that video we were discussing, you'll see a crew that's walking with a Thomas pack and a backboard over an environment that Dr. Joe mentioned. You know, there's a lot of jagged edges and a lot of uneven surfaces, and you watch them struggle walking with this gear. So I think being light and agile and, you know, directed to the point with your setup is very important. Plus, I would also probably offer that there may be some things around you in that environment that you could utilize for splinting or backboarding, you know, that may not be necessarily a trade tool, but, you know, a door, a piece of broken 2x4, you know, whatever the case may be. So you don't necessarily have to carry that stuff in with you.
Yeah, and I saw you emailed the link on that. It's on YouTube, so anybody can see it. Maybe get Jamie to put that up, because this was a real scenario. This was a real F5 tornado. These were the ambulance folks in the situations that they were caught in. The other piece of that is the ambulance that just stopped because they couldn't go anywhere, and suddenly they were in ER. So it's really amazing, and I think you made the point to us, Chris, off air, that the humanity involved and how everybody was taking care of everybody and how they just had to go with what they had. I think there's a lot to be said for that. So maybe you can put that link up. That'd be a good discussion to have later.
Yeah, I think what you'll need to do is send me the link, and we can maybe post it directly on the Disaster Podcast Facebook page, definitely. And then I'll have the link in the show notes for this episode.
Ah, good idea. Oh, actually, it was Kyle that sent us that. Thank you, Kyle. You were quick. Thanks for putting that up. So, Kyle, to you, now, most of your work in that arena seems to be in the winter environment, and, of course, weather is a definite factor in what you're going to pack, both as far as your personal gear, because Joe and I were talking about how different our federal packing is if it's summer versus winter, because the winter, of course, carrying the clothing and so forth is a lot more bulky. So I'm sure you do things outside the winter environment, but weather is certainly a factor depending on where you are, where you're going, what to expect, especially, I mean, how many times a year do we hear about people in the summer hiking around the mountains with nothing but a t-shirt and a pair of shorts and maybe a bottle of water, and then they get lost up in there and it turns cold at night. So what are your thoughts?
Well, Sam, as you kind of hinted at, I come at this from not only a wilderness first responder and EMT standpoint, but also, as you say, from the winter environment, operating as a ski patroller out here in Colorado and back in the Midwest. So it's a little diverse, and I'll start by saying that I completely agree with all the great discussions so far and the comments from everyone here on the panel. But just kind of thinking very briefly, you know, I go back kind of to the basics. I'm thinking about, you know, immediate life threats, you know, the ABCs. And so just some things that come to mind for me in a kind of a response kit for an austere environment is, you know, thinking about carrying, I always carry three sizes of oral airways and two different sizes of nasal airways. So I carry a 24 and a 28 French for the nasal airways. I'm also thinking about bleeding, so I'll carry like an Israeli bandage or some kind of compression bandage, and also a one or more commercial tourniquets, depending on how much space I have in my pack. The space blanket, I totally agree with that one as well, since, again, we're always thinking about exposure for our patient. If we can keep them from getting shocky on us, it's always ideal to have that. And, of course, we don't know, depending on what kind of environment we're in, how far we are from the next level of care and being able to be evacuated. It's always good to have some way to keep that person warm and help keep them a little bit more stable while we're waiting for transport. Nitrile gloves, of course, are always important nowadays because, I'll just throw it out there. Other people are just kind of nasty when you think about it from a medical standpoint. And it's one always the thing that I'm putting in my kits. And of course, duct tape you can never go without. And I'll even throw out there, perhaps depending on the environment that you're operating in, a fingertip pulse oximeter, or pulse ox as it's called, can also be a good tool to just be one more piece of information kind of as a diagnostic when you're assessing someone who may be injured. And one thing that I got from my training with the National Outdoor Leadership School was it's always good in an austere environment to have we had in our kits a 10cc syringe in case you need to irrigate any kind of open wound to prevent infection, which can help reduce the amount of supplies you're using down the line if you're looking at an extended care scenario. And of course, for me operating outside, a waterproof notepad and a space pen are always, always a must. That way I can, you know, log, get the history from my patient, the sample history. I can, you know, log vitals there and any other information I may need to give to a party who may have to hike out or go to a place where, say, if it's an amateur radio or whatever kind of communication system you have, they can then relay that to the authorities who can then send the proper resources to help us out.
I think that's a good kit there, and certainly I like the addition of the notepad and the space pen, just to make sure you can keep track of what's going on and as you get a chance to, and save your memory for more important things. I'm a big proponent of writing things down so I don't have to remember them. So that's a good choice.
Yeah, Sam forgot to hit the mute button there, so I was talking to myself again. Jamie will jump in there and save me like he does every time. Yes, and I think that notebook is really an essential for Ski Patrol, because you'd be sitting there trying to take notes down, and it's snowing like crazy. So, yeah, that definitely comes out of that arena. But, you know, Joe, he mentioned hypothermia, which is clear when you're in the snow or in a cold weather environment. But we don't always think about it in terms of other things. Like I was writing a scene on a confined space situation, and he reminded me that hypothermia was something we had to be concerned about, even though it was a fairly warm environment. But, you know, there are situations like that where hypothermia is, we don't always think about it. I think about it in terms of, even in a regular everyday situation, the elderly who may not have the adipose tissue, may not have, their bodies don't have the ability to vasoconstrict and vasodilate like they did when they were younger. And sometimes you might have someone who's hypothermic that you may not even realize that's part of the problem.
Well, and I think we need to realize that any temperature that's not 98 degrees outside is, you know, lower than that temperature could cause somebody to be prone to hypothermia, especially if they're in a situation where they're starting to get shock state due to blood loss or something like that that's compromised them. All those things, I think, you know, need to be kept in mind whenever the temperature's below, you know, warm weather.
Well, especially when they're there, because it doesn't have to be terribly cold, but if they're in it for a prolonged period of time, I think that's a factor. What do you think, Joe?
Well, I completely agree, and I think you also have to take into account whether or not they are wet or not, and whether or not they are in direct contact with something besides air. You know, it's going to take a lot longer to lose heat through the air than it is if you are wet and in direct contact with something like concrete. Which tends to, you know, suck heat out of you pretty quickly. So I don't think that we pay as much attention to the concerns of hypothermia in all the different environments we've been talking about as we should. They're quite obvious in situations like Kyle was describing. And, you know, I think nobody's going to have an issue with it there. But just as Jamie pointed out, if it's, 59 degrees outside and you're wet, you are losing body heat quite rapidly, and hypothermia can be an issue in those situations as well.
Absolutely. And I one thing we haven't mentioned that I am a very big fan of as far as handling trauma in the field is triangular bandages. Some good ones. In fact, when I was doing Ski Patrol, you know, the cheesy ones that they give you on the ambulance that are not very big and not very sturdy, we made our own. We made nice big ones, and there's just so many different things you can do with them. But as we wrap up here, Joe, you know, you had to know I was going to ask this. But about 2 years ago, some of you guys don't listen to all the episodes, I asked Joe a question. I asked the whole group a question about what's the one thing in your pack you couldn't live without. And when Joe said a Foley catheter, we about all fell out of our chairs. But we revisited that with this book I'm working on, and I'm amazed at all of the different things that can be done with it. You can make a chest tube out of it. One thing I hadn't heard Joe say before was you could stop a leak in a water bottle with it. You can use it as a tourniquet. What are some of the other things, Joe, if you remember?
Yeah, there's a lot of those. You know, if you have a, you know, a rubber raft or something like that that's got a hole punched in it, then you stick the catheter in the hole, you blow the balloon up, and you pull it back against the hole, and you seal the hole up. So, you know, from a surgical quote unquote standpoint, there's a lot of different uses for something like that. Obviously, you're not going to be doing that many advanced surgical procedures in the pre-hospital world, but we're in that environment. But if you are pushed into a situation where you have to do that, you know, it can be handy for all those kind of things. For example, you know, a wound drain or something like that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and as a physician, you'd be more inclined certainly to do something like that if it meant life or death for somebody. So, you know, we should maybe go to the Facebook page and throw it out there. It's like, what are all the things you can think of doing with a Foley catheter? So, but I had to bring that up because even though we laugh about it, it is very real. And you could probably take a number of other things that you don't think about as being a one-use item and think about all the other things that you might do with it. So I'm sure Kevin and BJ could come up with a few, Kevin especially being a wilderness trainer. So anyway, we got to wind down here, but, you know, it always kind of comes back down to thinking about these things, preparedness, and certainly training. Kyle was talking about the training he had that gave him some good ideas on things and how to multitask and use different things for whatever purpose you need them for. So it always seems to go back to that. And I'm sure, Joe, when you guys at Paragon are doing some of your active shooter or any other types of training you do, that the things you take with you and the things you need, and I'm sure those questions come up in your training, which if we're going to do an active shooter, what do you carry in a pack for an active shooter scenario if that's what you're likely to be involved in? Is that true or not?
Well, we absolutely talk about stuff like that. And again, I think the there is no single answer that, you know, to that question, because there are so many different variables that are dependent upon that. And it may vary inside the system. Is it a weekend? Is it, you know, at a outdoor event versus, you know, something at the mall? There's just so many variables in there that make it really challenging to be prepared for every situation.
Joe, if people want to come and bring you guys in to talk about this, contact Paragon and see what kind of resources and training and specialized scenario building that you can bring to bear for their system. Where can they reach you?
They can find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or on Facebook under the same name. Our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU, and obviously they can reach out to us through the Disaster Podcast, both the website and the Facebook page.
And we want to thank you very much again, as always, for continuing to support so that we can bring the Disaster Podcast to people. And so we always urge our audience to head over and check out the Paragon site. You know, check them out. Think about them when a training opportunity comes out in your community. Maybe they are the best resource to check out and see what they can do.
Joe, you had a thought you wanted to throw out.
Well, I just wanted to say a special thank you to Mr. Cleveland that was kind enough to send us an email that prompted our conversation tonight. We really appreciate listeners like him, and wish him well, and thanks for listening.
And hopefully we'll hear back from him on how well this episode worked for him. Maybe put a few more things in his kit.
Definitely. Definitely. Chris, where can folks catch up with you? Are you active on our Facebook group or anything like that where they can leave a message for you?
I am active on your Facebook group. They can also reach me at my current employer at Samaritan EMS in Del City, Oklahoma, and I'd be glad to help out in any way I can.
Kyle, how about you?
Anyone can find me on all the social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson, always available to talk weather, medicine, or whatever else piques your interest.
Sam, and yourself?
And myself. You will find me on social media under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. And in the places we've discussed, the Facebook page, the disasterpodcast.com website. We hope this is how we got tonight's episode. So we'd love anybody else out there to come up with your thoughts and questions and throw us anything you want. We'll address it and we'll find an answer to it. What about you, Jamie?
Well, I'm under the handle PodMedic on most social media sites, but for the purposes of this episode and all these episodes, find me over at disasterpodcast.com or on our Facebook group. And we look forward to chatting with you and getting comments like this. So leave a comment on any of the episodes over at the website or leave a comment in the Facebook group. And we will be certain to get back to you. And if we have a special guest on, we'll get them to respond as well. So we want to hear from you. So please get back in touch with us. You know, Sam, thinking about all the disaster kits and things, it makes us continue to think about the differences between managing medical needs in an austere environment versus managing those needs where we have all the supplies we need, like in a hospital setting.
Absolutely. And I want to toss out one other thought, too. We haven't really mentioned this on the Disaster Podcast, and we should, but Jamie has a lot of other shows. If you go to MedicCast, you can find just about anything you want to find in terms of nursing and so forth and so on. And just check out what he's got out of there. You might learn some new things in some new arenas. But yes, what we're talking about is putting a kit together for the austere environment and all the variables that go with it. But it's just another example of the fact that disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.